So what I was talking about over the last two meetings was, I was talking about the five skandhas, and I was talking about sort of the perceptual process and the cognitive process and these kinds of things, which sounds very abstract and a theme that we wanted to work with this season was compassion. So how do these things fit together? And that I'm actually going to try and make the bridge tonight and in the meeting we have in 2 weeks when we talk about Vajrasattva again, because they do fit together. And the way they fit together is that, and let me go back to the perceptual conceptual process to make that linkage. The way they fit together is that Buddhists think about mind as, or consciousness as, a phenomenon that exists in time, that exists over moments of time. So when they talk about, in the skanda system, when they talk about perception and they talk about consciousness and a sense organ and an object arising together to create a moment, to create a perception, they're talking about a moment of perception. And they say that in a finger snap, there's 65 moments of consciousness. That's the speed of a moment they're talking about. And of course, we don't see that because it goes by so fast. And sort of the question of how did they know there were 65 in one finger snap is pretty interesting. And if you're really curious, we can come back to that in the Q&A, because I did talk to somebody about that at one point, and I'll share that with you. But anyway, if you think about that, you don't see those 65 moments zooming by because they go by so fast. There just seems to be a continuity. And it's pretty much the same as the way a fluorescent light works. You know, fluorescent light cycles on and off 60 times a minute, or second rather, 60 cycles a second. And so it seems like a continuous light, even though it's on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. But it's so fast that it goes faster than our supposed perceptual process can notice. But so it would be the same for these 65 moments of mind. Now, the reason this notion of moments is important is that according to the Buddhist epistemology, when you first see something or first hear something or first touch, smell, or taste something, in that first moment, there's just the raw sense experience of consciousness, an object, and a sense organ. But in the second moment, something else happens. And in the second moment, what happens is that all of your history of meaning and emotional reaction and everything else arises at the same time. So the second moment of awareness of something is not a fresh moment, and it's not a pure moment in the sense of pure, only meaning uncovered by thought or feeling or something like that. It is an actual awareness of what is given to the sense experience. But the second moment, bang, already meaning is connected with it. Habits, history, all that kind of stuff which we associate with our personality, with our personal history, with cultural history, with language, all these kinds of things. Well, so if there's 65 moments in a finger snap, basically speaking, we don't ever experience what's there without our bringing something to the experience. But what is important is that it is actually possible to get to that place if you're very good at meditation. Now, the second moment is usually viewed as you know, not really, not good or bad, not positive or negative. It's just sort of a fact that in the second moment, concepts in particular get attached to sensory experience. So, for example, if someone says to you, I had a nice day at the beach in Tillamook. Okay. The first moment you just hear those sounds, but in the second moment of awareness, what happens is beach, Tillamook, rain, Oregon coast, all these kinds of things come into your mind, and that's sort of the way you experience what's being said. So you attribute meaning to it. So in the first moment, it's just sound. The second moment, there's meaning. So that's the positive side, is that we attach meaning to things. But the negative side is, what's the meaning that we attach to things? Because it could be accurate, it could be inaccurate, it could be very prejudicial in the sense of biased. I don't mean like racially prejudicial or anything like that, but it's just sort of like you bring your own sense of things to construct meaning, and then that is immediately placed onto the experience, and from there on out, all the experience is covered with that meaning. And that's how we live, and that's okay. I mean, we couldn't get along if that wasn't going on. But as we're aware, the problem is that sometimes we have erroneous notions about things, and those things are attached. So like Mary and I were just talking about this course she's teaching on women in Islam. And, you know, for most people in the United States, you say the word Islam, and something gets attached to that word, and for the most part, it's not very positive for most people. And there are a lot of reasons for that. And it's mostly because they don't know anything about Islam except what the media has told them. And there's certain biases there and certain realities and there's conflict. And we're all human beings. And I mean, there are all kinds of stuff. But what is attached to that sound depends upon this very heavy complex. Now, from the point of view of Buddhist meditation, there's a positive and a negative side to this, because typically the process goes on without our being particularly aware of it, and we don't really do anything about it. But in fact, it doesn't have to be that way, because we could look at something and we could make a decision about what we want to think about while we're looking at it, or we can make a decision about what we want to think about when we're hearing it or anything else. You know, we might like rock and roll and find ourselves listening to classical music and thinking, well, I know I'm supposed to like this. This is supposed to be good for me. Let me listen to it really closely. And if we hold that thought in mind for a long period of time, even if we like rock and roll, we might find something in Stravinsky that we like, or, you know, or Beethoven that we like, just because we're holding a certain attitude, a certain thought, which begins to have an impact on our experience. So Buddhists use that. I mean, they use that in the sense of doing logical analysis about things, and so that you hold that logical conclusion in mind when you examine something. So when I was talking in the past about the Buddhist theory about emptiness, I mean, basically it starts out as a logical analysis, and then when you're meditating, you try to observe phenomena and think about them as being empty while you're observing them. That's a difficult process, because the way our mind wants to work is it wants to turn the thoughts around logically, which is kind of a temporal, time-bound situation. But there are some thoughts we have which are not so time-bound. And in particular, those thoughts are images. So now you see where I'm going with this. Because images are something that you can hold in place over a series of moments without having to kind of generate a lot of mentation about it, okay? So you can hold an image in mind in relationship to your experience and sort of continually stamp that experience with that image on a moment-by-moment basis. And that then, from their point of view, that then changes what the experience is, okay? So, for example, we have been talking about Vajrasattva practice. Okay, so what is the power of holding the image of Vajrasattva in your mind on a moment-by-moment basis, repeating the mantra on a moment-by-moment basis, which is to say creating a sound of a certain type, an image of a certain type, and then all of the experience that you're having during the moment you're doing those things are constantly being impressed with the image and the sound, and when you get to it, the meaning of Vajrasattva. So then that actually changes what your perceptions are, because perception is not the fresh moment the first time a perception occurs. Most of what perception is moments where an object and a concept are being mixed together. And the concepts that are being mixed with the object can be anything. I mean, if you sit quietly and watch the stream of your mind, you see what kind of stuff goes on in your mind. It's everything imaginable, right? So all that everything imaginable is continuously being impressed on your moment-by-moment experience of what's going on around you. Well, you know, I mean, if you know, well, okay, I'll use this kind of example. If you're raised in an Eastern European Jewish family, you're kind of a glass half empty guy like me, okay? So moment by moment, it's kind of like you don't necessarily expect the best thing to be going on in the world, to put it mildly. Now, Kay, on the other hand, was raised quite differently. She was raised to be a glass half full kind of gal. So moment by moment, because of that attitude, she tends to think of the world as like offering good stuff. Now, the very same thing, I mean, we can be walking down the street together looking at the very same thing, and we don't see the same thing, right? She sees something and thinks something positive is there. I see something and I think something's negative is there. You know, it's kind of like, wow, look at that squirrel on the tree, right? From her point of view, wow, a cute squirrel. From my point of view, is that going to drop a nut on my head? You know? I mean, I'm sort of, you know, I'm kind of stretching the concept. But you know, you laugh because you do understand what I mean here, okay? So if what we're interested in as human beings is creating a life which is happier, or creating a life where we have a more positive relationship with other people, so this would be called altruism or compassion. So we start with where we're at, but we can do something about it. And what we can do about it is we can change what our experience is on a moment-by-moment basis. Now, that's not to say it's easy. It's very difficult. There's no question about it. But it's within our capacity to do something. So we can either go through life, from the Buddhist point of view, we can either go through life and say, it is what it is, there's nothing I can do about it. Or we can say, it is what it is, but that's not okay. I want to do something about it because that's not the life I want to lead. I mean, I don't want to lead a life which is driven by negative habit patterns and negative attitudes and whatever. I want to lead a life where I have warm, friendly relations with people, or I expect good things to happen in the world, even if there's a lot of nastiness in the world. That doesn't mean I can't expect good things to happen in the world. And I want to lead a life where I'm seeing more clearly what's truly going on rather than my fantasies about what's going on. If only because my fantasies about what's going on is not likely to, my fantasies about what's going on are not likely to have a good alignment with reality. They're going to be aligned with my own fantasies. And if that's the case, reality is not going to be giving me what I want from it because I'm not meeting reality. I'm just meeting myself. And that, of course, is the problem because moment by moment, we go through life and it's not like we're living in the world. We're living in our own minds that are impressed on the world, that are covering the world. And this is how the process works, is that in each moment, because meaning and perception all come together in each moment of awareness, we're stuck wanting to experience what actually is, but we don't get beyond our own minds about what actually is. Now, our minds might tell us something very important about what's going on. It might be accurate, or it might not be. It's not to say that all concepts are wrong. It's simply to say that if we don't have the ability to control this process, then we're at the mercy of our own habits, whether positive or negative, right? And so who wants that? I mean, the whole idea in the Buddhist point of view is freedom and happiness. So how do we get there? And so this is the answer to how do you get there. So now back to Vajrasattva. Why Vajrasattva? So, you know, we have a lexicon of words that mean something to us. And we use it all the time to understand things. Some of us have a lexicon of images for understanding what's going on. Some of us have a lexicon of sounds. Like if you're a musician, you know, you have a way of relating to what's going on in the world that's very different than a person that's not a musician. Because sounds have a way of organizing your experience in a way that's I wouldn't want to say unique, but different than for people who don't live in that world. Kay is an artist, and the way she sees and organizes things, quite different than the way most people do. I'm a pretty rational and logical person, and that's why I organize things. But in truth, I don't organize things, my mind doesn't organize things in a strictly logical fashion. The way my mind works is very metaphorically. It's actually more poetic than anything else. So I'm very oriented toward language, but I'm not oriented toward the language, say, of logical discourse or science. I'm oriented toward the language of poetry or the language of geometry or something like that. So certain kinds of philosophy worked really well for me when I was a student, but other things didn't, because that was not the way my mind naturally organized things. But even if we have a lexicon of image, say, our lexicon of images is created by this culture. And it only goes so far, because this culture doesn't really have a lexicon for addressing what we could call spiritual truths, or religious truths, or whatever you want to call them. I mean, if you're Catholic, you have a lexicon of a certain kind of image. You might not feel too well about it, or you might, but there is a lexicon of imagery there. But in this culture, most Americans are Protestants, and they have a very, pardon my language, but shriveled lexicon of images, right? I mean, in the Protestant church, there are no women of spiritual dimension. In the Catholic church, there's Mary. And for some people, Mary is big, and for other people, Mary is sort of subsidiary. But she's at least there. In the Protestant church, where is she, you know? I mean, if you're born Jewish, I mean, there's a big problem, because Jews don't want any images, right? Same if you're a Muslim. Now, there are things that substitute. In the Muslim world, there are pattern, shape, color, texture. There are many things that substitute that spiritual meaning. And, you know, you could probably say the same thing about the Jewish religion. But the point is that different lexicons will accomplish ways of understanding experience, ways of impressing experience and transforming experience. So the Buddhist lexicon has this vast imagery and symbolism, which you would think, well, this is kind of obscure. How can this stuff possibly mean anything to me? I'm a 21st century American. Pardon me, I'm dating myself. It's hard to remember these things. I'm a 21st century American. So how can I, you know, how can this Buddhist lexicon make any sense to me and be valuable to me? So I was very fortunate in actually asking this question of the Dalai Lama in the early 80s when I was in Dharamsala. I was doing some research, but I had an opportunity to meet with him three times to interview him for a psychology journal. And the second group of times I met with him, I had a set of questions that were posed by the readers in the journal. First time, they were my questions. The second and the third meeting, they were questions of readers or editors of the journal. And somebody asked, well, all this imagery in Tibetan Buddhism, I mean, how does this work? I mean, why would it work for us? And this is the early 80s. And his answer was very interesting. He said, all the imagery in Tibetan Buddhist practice originally came from India, didn't come from Tibet. Very different time, very different culture, different language, different people, different traditions, different everything. But you know, for the last 1,000 years, we've noticed that it works for us. It worked for them. It works for us. It'll work for you. That's more or less what he said. I mean, you can get the literal, if you want to look it up, you can find the journal article, you find what he literally said. But that's more or less what he said. So, okay, why? Why does it do that? Now, so that's a whole other deep subject, which I won't get into tonight, because it would really take us astray. My own views as somebody who was a psychologist earlier in my life are very Jungian, and that kind of gets at some issues, but there are other ways of thinking about these things. Anyhow, he said they work. So for the moment, let's just take it for granted that they do, And if you want to, we can have sidebar discussions about why might they work. Okay, so they do work. So how do they work? Well, the way they work is when you hold a certain image in mind, and for each moment of awareness, it impresses itself on the perceptual process. Now, it's true, none of us in this room can get into the moments of awareness so we can see, here's a finger snap, there was one, there was two, there was three, there was four, up to 65, and now it's the next finger snap moment. But that doesn't matter, because if we hold the image in our mind while the process is going on, it's impressing itself on every one of those moments that we're paying attention, which of course is the rub. Because if your mind is like my mind, you know, it's there, and then about 1 second later, my mind is somewhere else. I mean, this morning I was trying really hard to do my meditation practice, but I've discovered eBay. And there was this auction, and at 5 minutes... And at 5 minutes to 11, I had to be online, right, to get the last bid in before the auction closed. So I'm sitting around doing my meditation practice, and it's like I'm on my meditation practice, and then suddenly I'm in the future, and I'm on eBay, and then I'm back to my meditation. You know, and it's just back and forth, back and forth. Well, that's just the way it is. So, you know, sometimes it takes a while before I notice that I'm on my auction site rather than sitting on my meditation cushion, but I yank myself back and you just do it over and over and over again, you know, and that's just the way it is. Now, truth be told, as far as that goes, you know, you get better at yanking yourself back. Also, truth be told, we can probably do this for the next 20 years and we're still be yanking ourselves back. It could be the case that in 20 years you can hold your mind on one image or one concept for, you know, a whole 30 seconds without being distracted, and that might be an accomplishment of half a lifetime. So we also have to be very gentle and compassionate with ourselves, you know. I mean, we're all middle-aged or more here, and we were not raised with mind training as part of our experience. We were not raised, we didn't learn how to concentrate, and so on and so forth. Now, I think musicians have an advantage over us in that respect. But for most of us, it's sort of like, you know, we were raised and trained in such a way as following logical discourse and analysis and so on and so forth was what we were trained to do, if we got into that even. Depends on what kind of education we had. But we were not trained to concentrate our mind and hold up one-pointedly on something. So we have a lot of work to do. But as I said earlier, what are the choices? I mean, what else is there to do? What are we going to do? You know, we can just say, that's just the way it is. I'll drink a couple of beers and forget about it. That's what a lot of people do. Or we can say, no, you know, I actually tried that. It didn't work for me. I'm going to have to do something else. And so this is something else. and if nothing else, what this does is it provides a sense of meaning. Otherwise, we're just sort of like victims of circumstance. And here, we're looking at an opportunity to take control of our own mental condition in our lives, even if we fail repeatedly. Still, we're living in a different space, which is a space of intention and an attempt at control rather than passivity in the face of circumstance and our own upbringings and our culture and whatnot. And so I'm not trying to say anything negative about our culture and our upbringing. I'm just saying it is what it is. I mean, you know, if you're a young Tibetan and you're sent to a monastery when you're 7 years old, you get a different kind of training. And by the time you're older, you have a very good memory and the ability to concentrate your mind. And in ways that would be surprising to us. I mean, for example, Lhotse Rinpoche, who's our current teacher, who's this... a monk on the right in these two pictures, was once having a conversation with us. And he grew up and got his entire education up to the equivalent of a PhD when he was in Tibet. And poor. These people were just poor, and they're living in stone monasteries, and nobody had anything. And he studied like crazy. But he couldn't afford butter lamps. They didn't have candles. They had lamps with little butter wicks, wicks in them, and yak butter to light. He couldn't even afford, you know, a yak butter lamp. But he said, but it didn't matter, because When he was young, he had to memorize all the scriptures that were important and all the commentaries that were important. He said, so he'd sit in his room in the dark and he would just remember what the commentary was, and in his mind he'd just turn the pages and he'd read it because he could remember the entire thing. Okay? As in thousands of pages he could remember. And it's a good thing because his final exam was the teacher would be, well, the teacher, I mean, the people who conducted the final exam would say something like the equivalent of, you know, on chapter 3, page 7 of the Dharmakirti, blah, 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 he says blah, 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 and then the next thing is fill in the blank. Can't fill in the blank? You fail. You know, so they had a different kind of mind and they had a different kind of ability to concentrate. So I share this with you partly from humor, but also partly to say that this kind of practice comes out of a tradition of mind control and mind training, which is not just alien, but astonishing to us. But still, that doesn't mean we can't practice and make progress. And I know that's true because nobody has a wandering mind like my own. And I've been at it for years, and it does produce results, even if you have an incredible fantasy life, wandering mind, inability to concentrate, which is me. Okay? So don't give up hope. Even if you don't think you can do it, and even if you can't do it, it still produces interesting results. And one of the reasons it produces interesting results is because these images carry meaning. So one of the things that Kay was talking about was Vajrasattva is the image of male and female together. And you know, for a lot of people, it's like, wow, that's a little weird, you know. Buddha, who has a male side and a female side, and they're embracing each other, what's this? Well, you know, when you have an image in your mind of a male-female embracing, and I don't mean sexually embracing, I just mean embracing, okay, that conveys something. It conveys something at a deep emotional level. And when you're holding that deep emotional level of that image of that symbol, it has a consequence, it has an outcome. Even if you don't know logically, rationally, exactly what that's going to be, there is something that's there. Okay? And all the symbolism that's associated with Vajrasattva works that way. In fact, all the symbolism that's associated with everything in this lexicon of Tibetan Buddhism works this way. Many times in ways which are highly unexpected, incomprehensible, illogical or irrational, it doesn't really make any difference because it's not dealing with our logical, rational mind. It's dealing with another part of our mind. It's dealing with the part of our mind that's active when we're dreaming. You know, the dream life doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, but it's very important. You know, when we have a night of awful dreams, we wake up crabby. When we have a night of wonderful dreams, we wake up feeling good. And we've all had that experience, okay? What's going on in our unconscious or our subconscious, whatever you want to call it, is determining our emotional state, is determining the way we relate to others, the way we relate to everything that's going on, you know? When I'm walking down the street in the morning going to work, if I'm walking down the street and my mind is a peaceful place, you know, I notice the trees, I notice the cats, I notice the school kids, and it's all good. And it's all positive. It doesn't matter if the wind is blowing snow on my face. It really doesn't matter. That's okay too. But if I start the day out in a crabby place for whatever reason, I had a crummy night, not enough sleep, whatever the case may be, you know, didn't get my breakfast, you know, I go down the list of what it can be, and I'm walking to work and the snow's blowing my face, you know, and the kids at school, they're looking dumb, you know, and like the cats running across the enemy. You know what it is? It is. This is what it is. So why not do something about it? So most of the time I actually try. Most of the time when I'm walking to work, I'm actually doing Vajrasattva most of the time. Right? And why is that? Because in Vajrasattva practice, one of the things that you imagine is you imagine Vajrasattva sitting on your head, radiating white light everywhere. Now, it's true that Vajrasattva is showering you with this white light, and we can get into talking about what this white light is, or multicolored light, or wherever you want to be. But really, the way you practice is it's not like there's this like beam of light that's coming down out of Vajrasattva straight down, and you're the only one that's getting it, and then the dark stuff is going out your feet into the earth and being composted by whoever's down there. but it's like 360 degrees all the way around, this light is going out. And, you know, Vajrasattva may love you, which is to say that the higher part of yourself loves you, because that's what Vajrasattva is. It's like the deepest part of you. But Vajrasattva feels the same way about everybody else. And why is that? Because that part of you is also that part of them. And it's like that part of you is liking that part of them, that's that part of them, which is that part of you. So how do you imagine this, right? So, you know, like that kind of language would drive you crazy after a while. But you can imagine this image of Vajrasattva radiating light, which includes everybody, right? So this luminosity, which is bathing you in this kind of peaceful feeling, and you will feel this after a while, that can bathe everybody. That peaceful feeling can bathe everybody. Now, whether they feel it or not, we can have a complicated conversation about that. And we can next week. But the point is that from the point of view of our own practice, if we're imagining Vajrasattva taking care of us and Vajrasattva taking care of everybody else, then what are we doing? We're having a different kind of relationship with everybody else on a moment-by-moment basis, one that's predicated on caring about other people. Now, the people who drive by in their cars dropping the kids off at high school, I'm not going to have any conversation with them. So how can I care about them? Well, only my attitude is the way I'm going to care about them. Right? So this is attitudinal. This is attitude adjustment. So the whole way in which I am in relationship to these people that I never see, because they're zooming by, never meet because they don't get out of their cars, never talk to, don't know who they are, where they live, or what they're doing, it doesn't make any difference. Because this light is radiating out to everything around. Now, if I was a great practitioner, it'd be radiating out across the entire planet. So I'm not a great practitioner. I can sort of keep the Grand Ronde Valley in my mind. That's pretty big. That'll have to do, you know. Okay. You know, we have mountains all the way around us. Okay, that's fine. So I'll do what I can to fill up this bowl with good stuff. I don't know how many people live here, but this is my attitude adjustment. And, you know, does it make any difference or not? It makes a difference to me. Does it make a difference to them? We can talk about that. Kay's experience has been that, in fact, it does, because she's done this kind of practice with other people who she's had kind of gnarly relationships with, and she says, you know, those relationships improved. Was it because I changed, because they changed, because we both changed? Depends on how metaphysical you want to be. In a sense, it doesn't make any difference because something changed because you took something in hand to do something about the situation. Okay. So, we can talk more about the symbolism of Vajrasattva, and we can do that in 2 weeks. But having introduced the practice again, you know, I wanted to share a perspective on Buddhism is not a faith-based philosophy or religion. It's very practical. And everything that goes on in this tradition is comprehensible within the context of a psychology or an epistemology or an ontology or whatever you want to talk about. There's not one thing that can't be connected to a pretty rational or almost scientific perspective, because everything in Buddhism comes out of people's experience and is articulated in relationship to those experiences. And Buddhism as a tradition has a very interesting, I don't know if you want to call this a problem or a lineage or what it is. Buddha didn't write anything because there was no writing when he lived. Okay? But he said a lot and people remembered it and they transmitted it. And one of the things he said is, don't believe anything I have to say just because I said it. Subject it to testing. Subject it to rational analysis. Subject it to your own inner experience. If it doesn't match up, be rid of it, or wait until you have a chance to see it more closely and then decide whether to accept it or reject it. You know, we can't really see into the 65 moments of consciousness in each finger snap. So we might want to say, okay, I don't know how true this is or not. I'll suspend judgment for the time being. But there are other things that we can look at and we can say, you know, this makes sense. Based upon how I understand my perceptual process to work, I can see how thoughts have this kind of impact, Therefore, if I have a different kind of thought, it's going to have that kind of impact. Okay, how do I have that different kind of thought? Well, if I'm being, you know, doing a big rational analysis, I may miss the curb and fall over, right? So, but if I'm only holding an image in my mind, I won't miss the curb and I can walk to work in the morning. Okay, so this is the advantage of images. I mean, you can do that kind of thing. And you can pretty much do that with everything in the Buddhist tradition. And if it doesn't make sense, you can work it and it'll eventually make sense. And if it still doesn't make sense, then you can find somebody who's already been there and check in with them and say, explain it, please. But if they can't explain it, then in the Buddhist philosophical religious tradition, you're not only free to say, well, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to accept that. It's incumbent upon you that you reject it. I mean, one of the things that's been very interesting about what's happened in the Tibetan, I don't want to call it church, but the Tibetan monastic tradition under the current Dalai Lama is he's been very interested in science. So there's a lot of pre-scientific stuff in the Buddhist tradition. And he says, you know, if this stuff doesn't meet what we know from the scientific tradition, throw it out. So for example, in the old Abhidharma texts, says that the world is in the center of the universe. And that that it's sitting on a continent and it's surrounded by some other continents and that's it. And in some traditions, it's sitting on the back of a turtle. And so he's saying, all right, that's old, throw that out. And some of the more conservative monks are made unbelievably uncomfortable by that. He said, it does not line up with a rational, analytic, scientific, investigatory experience. It needs to be rejected. So then, you know, having said that, then of course he has many Westerners who say, well, what about reincarnation? Right? He says, well, how are you going to subject that to scientific analysis? When you can subject that to scientific analysis, if you can find out it's not true, fine, then we'll have to throw it out. Show me the data, please. Yeah. No one's shown him the data yet, because that's not the sort of thing he can subject to scientific analysis. Well, he's clever, he knows that in advance. But the point is that really, and what I want to share with you is that although we're working with images and we're working with symbols and maybe everything doesn't make sense right away, there is a frame of reference for it all in which eventually it does make sense if you're willing to just say, I'll suspend my judgment for a little while and see what happens. Because maybe I can't understand what a Vajra refers to, okay? So let me hang out with it for a while. Let me hang out with that image for a while. And although I may not know what it refers to, I might be able to see what the effect is of holding that in my mind for a long period of time. And I can look at that effect. And if that has a positive effect, then I can say, well, I don't understand it, but it seems to do some good things for my frame of mind. I guess maybe I'll hang out with it for a while longer until it starts to make some degree of sense. And maybe it'll never make any sense, but it seems to be cool anyway. So I've been at Tibetan Buddhism since the late 70s, and believe me, there's more stuff that doesn't make sense in the symbolic environment than what does make sense. And I've long since stopped worrying about it. Because, you know, my mind is like this big, and the tradition's like that big. Okay, we're not going to get this on the recording. So my mind is this big, which is like, you know, grapefruit size, and the tradition is bigger than from one fingertip to another when I stretch my arms out. My mind can't encompass the tradition, and I'm a relatively smart person. I don't even worry about it anymore. It doesn't matter, because I've seen it work. For me, it's worked. So that's a good place to end.